This is a recording of the 1986 Charles Walters Laying It Out in Space at Acres USA conference. It's around half an hour.
Good morning. Good morning to everybody. I hope you rested well. I think we have some wonderful speakers today. I'll try to set the tone in a few remarks I've prepared for you myself. I have to refer you back to our October issue, in which the headline read, "But No One Laid It Out in Spades." I had reference to the Farmers and Ranchers Congress held under the money, banner, and auspices of Willie Nelson in St. Louis shortly before the election. It was an array of politicians with the wisdom of what? If I were stating it in terms of science, I'd say Stone Age. We were told by Hightower, Secretary of Agriculture, how the rascals were cheating the farmers. We were told by Senator Harkin how he was going to roll up his sleeve and fight. You know, on election day, I had occasion to drive approximately from Kansas City to the Oklahoma line. And in the process, I heard a number of people on the radio being interviewed, but mostly commercials for candidates running for something from county commissioner on up. I tell you, you farmers are the most lucky people in the world. You've got fighters out there by the hundreds. They are your friends. And they will roll up their sleeves and go to work. And I sometimes wonder why you're in the position you're in with all these heady fighters and these courageous people. I think most of them are probably even sincere. The problem is what they don't know, they just simply don't know. And so I ask a question this morning: how has this process been contrived of stripping threadbare an entire population that at one time owned at least 40 acres of virgin land? The quote you will recognize is from Ferdinand Lundberg in The Rich and the Super Rich. And over the past 6 months, we've attempted to answer that question in Acres USA, specifically in the last word column. And what I have tried to relate to you is how a gigantic trust came into being in 1913. How science was fenced in to serve that master, its sustenance being drawn chiefly from the government and from foundations created for the purpose of serving the merchant. No less than 6 last word entries, almost all of them dealing with the legal process, with this business of claiming for the government legitimacy, which every government seems to claim. And I think we've informed you how your rights have been done away with, not by force of arms, but by the cleverness of lawyers and legal sleight of hand. I'm not going to recite anew what we've said in these columns. You have it. But we're going to start talking about a new thing that's an extension of the legal revolution, the one that has taken the Constitution and sequestered it from the American life while putting you entirely under a contract arrangement with your government. Christopher Hollis was in the United States from England back in the 30s. He was a professor at Notre Dame, and he wrote a book called The Breakdown of Money. And what Christopher Hollis pointed out, that the judgment was made in the wake of the establishment of the Federal Reserve System to break down the buying power of the American dollar so those indifferent American industrialists would have to hunt the world over for new markets to consume their production, because the American people were no longer able to consume their own production. This world was best accomplished, this world that they envisioned, best accomplished and accommodated the wishes of the international traders and that gigantic trust that Lindbergh, Congressman Lindbergh, spoke about, the Federal Reserve. Only in a dire emergency have these managers of public policy departed from this grand plan. In World War I, Herbert Hoover was appointed economic czar. And the first thing he did was to raise the price of wheat to parity and a little above. Because that way, and only that way, with the storable commodities that accounted for the production off of 80% of the harvested acres, could the income be generated on an earned basis to fight the war. That act was repeated when World War II broke out. Within months after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, the United States got a stabilization measure. And that stabilization measure had attached to it a Stigall Amendment that accounted for parity for the storable commodities and also for the semi-storable commodities. It was a stabilization measure for the American economy and not for the farmer. But you see, that 1913 game plan was only on the back burner. It was not off the stove at all. Early in the 30s, because the Constitution said that treaties had to be ratified by the Senate, a new nomenclature was invented: reciprocal trade agreements. These agreements were structured and titled so they could be executed without that unhandy reference to the Senate for ratification. It was part of this earlier game plan, the one that accommodated that gigantic trust that had been created. I think some parts of this story you've been told before. I'll sketch it very briefly. We did have that stabilization during World War II. We did not have it during the Korean War or during the Vietnam War. But in 1948, this stabilization for practical effects was terminated. We invented at that time something that we're using right now, and I'll cover it with you a little later. They called it the Brannon Plan in those days. There would have to be structured some sort of a subsidy arrangement to keep the American farmer from going broke too fast while we put our production into international trade channels at world prices. That was the Farm Bill of 1948. It was signed by Harry Truman. It extended the full par arrangement for a year or two, and then it went into effect. It was delayed until Eisenhower finally took office. But something happened during that period of time. When the British saw that we were no longer going to maintain a structural balance for the American economy, they devalued the British pound, and with that went all the sterling bloc nations. This made the United States the high market of the world. And in the next 5 years, we imported so much material, like kinds, wheat, corn, and so on, over what we exported, we piled up a $6 billion surplus. A very big amount in those days. A very big amount. But this wasn't our opener at the importing game. We imported more farm goods than we exported during each of the Depression years. Translated into a single crop, into wheat, it accounted for 10 crops of wheat being imported into the United States during the 30s. We imported more than we exported each of the war years. We didn't feed the world, but because we had this structural balance, some of our people weren't living on beans 6 nights a week. They had a steak now and then. And the red meat industry bounced back. And so did dairy. And so did all the storable commodities back to the 1929 level. And they did it within a matter of months after the stabilization went into effect. We imported more than we exported between 1946 and 1950. In 52. And then went into our sliding parity, where we determined we were going to use the Brannan expression. In order to accommodate this change in farm politics, and farm pricing, we introduced into the system a technology that should have been ruled from the scene by reasonable people. I take the position that it's 30 years overdue. It's 30 years overdue that we should have gotten rid or had a public policy to phase out the chemicals of organic synthesis. There's some of it happening now, not because of public policy, but because farmers are coming to their senses in the usual way, one at a time. There are some missed lessons in this. In this process I've described in a very faint sketch, we have introduced a concept to the American people, and most of all to the American farmer. There isn't one in 1,000 that doesn't believe it as an article of faith. And that concept is that we produce so much we couldn't use it if we stayed up all night eating. You believe it? Why, they've got granaries running down the street, and every fall somebody piles soybeans on the main street of a small town. But the fact is, we're not even self-sufficient. Do you think that Jimmy Carter embargoed our crops because of Afghanistan? He embargoed them because we were getting dangerously low in our inventories. We are importing 15% of all the red meat in international trade channels. Translate that into feed grain consumption. Is it any wonder we've got granaries and bins full of corn and feed grains? I think we need to rethink the equation. In a couple of our recent issues, we've carried an expression of this using government statistics on pork and beef. I think we've proved beyond a shadow of a doubt the validity of what I'm telling you. Ladies and gentlemen, it is not that surpluses bring on faltering parity for farming. It's quite the opposite. Faltering parity brings on surpluses because we do not generate the income that enables us to consume the production. Our resources and labor have accounted for. It's Christopher Hollis all over again. Way back when Henry Ford was the prime industrialist of the United States, he said, the American labor force has to have 50 cents an hour, because if it doesn't earn 50 cents an hour, it cannot buy a Model T Ford. He took the lead and raised the wage level to 50 cents an hour in the automobile industry, and others followed suit. But our newspaper pundits complain about subsidies. Our Kansas City Star guru last Sunday declared that trade deficits were really a good thing. Now this is economic illiteracy speaking. It's worse than that. It's madness. I'm going to leave it to our good friend R.E. McMaster to expand on that. I think he could probably do a better job, because I know this klutz. Not McMaster, the one on the Kansas City Star. It has a troublesome reality of our time. We have these professors, we have these government experts who with a straight face talk about trading partners. Since when is the guy you're trading or in competition with your partner? But this is all the nomenclature we're being used. I had a thing hit my office some months ago from Sri Lanka. Bring your industry to Sri Lanka. We have, and it gave the figure, how many thousand well-trained workforce at a monthly wage of $35 an hour, a month, which computes to about 8-9 cents an hour. That's real efficiency, ladies and gentlemen. I wish all these people working for me would just come in and work for free. God, would we get efficient. I suspect that many of these pundits come about these conclusions that there is some real basis for trade between a 10-cent an hour country and a $10 an hour country, because when they go to Egypt, they stay at the Hilton Ramses. The service is better than the service here. The prices are American prices, not Egyptian prices. And when they go to Rio de Janeiro, they see Sugarloaf in the distance, and the hotel they stay in is nonpareil. The service is excellent. The food is good. That poverty in those favelas on the hill is an abstraction, just as the poverty here is an abstraction. They go in their little academic seminars and they talk about trading partners and free international trade and cycles and all that thing. And they don't pause to realize there is no basis for this. There's all the difference in the world between these countries, the conditions under which they labor. Well, if this were our game, what business do we have having Social Security or workman's compensation or unemployment insurance or health care or retirement programs? If we're going to compete with the world that way, then let's start getting on some dirt floors, because that's where your labor is going to live. Some part of it is happening, however. You read in the paper, General Motors is closing X number of plants. All your high-salaried employees are being hired early. Compute 1992, possibly labor force states will have later entered labor channels at the $4.5 an hour range. We're in of reducing everybody to those $4 and $5 an hour range. And it's hard to domain an American standard of living at that wage rate. It isn't even worth it for your farm wife to leave the work for 4 and 5 hours. She can do more for herself, anything, any kind of cottage approach from the farm, than she can get in the lake today. It's just to this unreality that we have programs, that we tax ourselves goofy, that we'll accept any cockamamie